Hello, and
Hi.
welcome. Hi, to Resting Witch Face, your one-stop haunt for all things spooky, bitchy, and a little bit more. I am Fran, aka Grant Jacoby.
I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like,
I'm Abby from work. Oh, shit, I dropped you. Fuck. Keep it in.
This is going so great. Okay, hi, I'm Bailey. So happy to see you. Dirnt. For anybody who doesn't know what we're talking about, it's when all the names that
it's a callback.
It's a callback. Yeah, we are comedians. When all the names that Grant gets on his Starbucks cup. Although I will say, Grant, like I really stopped going to Starbucks like years ago. Like, isn't the coffee kind of bad? Like, this is a hot take. I don't know.
I don't actually get coffee from Starbucks. I really really like their green tea.
Okay.
Ice green tea, unsweetened, light ice. I also like their, if I'm feeling really bougie and I want to drop $8 on a coffee beverage, I'll do a venti soy iced chai, no sweetener.
Wow.
No sweetener, light ice.
Okay. I do want to let the listeners know that Grant is wearing like sort of an extreme tank top.
Yes.
And I have already gotten a flash of nipple, and I'm hoping that I'm going to get more flashes of nipple. So, and there they are. Wow.
Yeah, this
gorgeous.
Is, I am wearing the sluttiest of tanks I have, which was, I purchased this like, okay, so a thing I really like to do these days, A, because I'm just always warm, and B, because I'm just like, maybe I'm finally embracing being like a bear and still wanting to show off my body. Is like buying like XXL t-shirts and cutting the sleeves off. So this is a Lady Gaga Chromatica merch, former t-shirt, now a tank.
It was Floralia 2012.
It is. No, I feel like I'm living my true unmasked Coachella fantasy.
Yeah, I don't know if we ever talked about how our college randomly had like a one day music festival every spring.
A lot of schools do that though.
Yeah, a lot of schools do it. It was such a mess, like an extremely messy time where everyone would like get their place on the lawn and start drinking sort of at like 6 a.m. and just go for 20 hours.
Oh, yeah. You know? Well, I never understood the whole like, yeah, like wake up at 2-3 a.m. to go stake out a spot. Like I was kind of like, okay, like at a certain point when you're watching the concert, you're going to go down to like the was it Crow Pit? Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
Wow. Pulled that right out of my ass. But also what was nice, and I mean, I'm sure you can relate, is like a lot of our other friends did care about having a spot in the front.
That's so what I was going to say. It was like, babe, we just mooched off someone else's spot. You're like, I didn't get it when people got up really early to get a spot because I was just always naturally in the front row. It's like so weird.
so crazy that just like naturally happened every single time.
So weird. Anyway, oh so God, yeah, that's the vibe that Grant's outfit is giving right now.
Yeah,
so.
full spring fling day drink realness.
But anyway, welcome back to Resting Witch
Face.
Yeah,
welcome. I have something to discuss.
Please.
And I was going to do this as a complaint, and then I was like, okay, it's not quite a complaint. It's just like some discourse I'm curious about, and I would like your opinion as a very like objective sort of stance. And also I'm kind of opening this up to viewers and listeners and whatnot, just because I'm really struggling with this concept. So as you know, big fan of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yes.
And I will say in recent years, they've done like a really, really good job of, or doing a much better job of casting a really diverse group of queens for each season, not only in terms of, you know, race and size and age and whatnot, but including trans queens. Mm-hmm. And the most recent season of Drag Race UK had an AFAB queen, so assigned female at birth. And it's been really just great to see like a full representation of mm-hmm. the art form of drag, which I'm fully going to acknowledge. I only kind of started understanding what drag was, like truly, probably in the past like 5 or 6 years when I started watching Drag Race. So I acknowledge that I've not done my due diligence. But in the most recent season of Drag Race, there is a cisgender heterosexual male
mm-hmm.
who's in the cast. And I feel like it's coming off of this, like, off of the heels of all these, you know, again, these trans queens and AFAB queen. Like, it's like, okay, like, we're making this progress. And I'm struggling to, as a cisgender homosexual man, to watch a cisgender heterosexual man in this sort of queer space.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to ever be exclusionary. And I think that actually one thing that's really great about drag is that it feels like very inclusive. And, you know, anyone who is dedicated to this art form can express themselves in that way, which I think is great. But there's something that's not quite feeling, doesn't feel quite right.
This is so interesting. I mean, I've seen some of this discourse, and I'll say right off the bat, like, I've seen some episodes of Drag mm-hmm. Race, but I've never been, I mean, like, I am a really big fan of it. I just am not super dedicated to it. Like, I haven't watched all the seasons. Yeah, I know. I haven't watched all the seasons mm-hmm. on my own because I really enjoy watching it with other people, especially like my friends who do know a lot about it. So I feel like I'm not like the most quote unquote qualified person to talk about this, but I don't know if there's a right answer is the thing, because I do think in some ways drag as an art form can be for anyone, but I mm-hmm. also think that it is a specifically queer safe space, especially exactly. and like RuPaul's Drag Race especially has been that for so many queer people. This is so interesting that you brought this up, because it's going to segue so beautifully into my badass bitches this week that actually
okay.
not the story that I'm doing, but okay. But this is kind of related. So I feel like I want to bring it up now.
Yeah, please.
So like I said, like, haven't seen all the seasons of Drag Race. However, I just caught up on the HBO Max series We're Here. Do you know what this is?
I do. I haven't watched it.
Okay, no problem. So I was going to explain the premise anyway, because I think a lot of people haven't seen it or haven't mm-hmm. heard of it. So it's in its second season, or it's finished its second season. And it's a documentary reality show that stars three queens that were on Drag Race. So Bob the Drag Queen, Shangela, and Eureka are mm-hmm. the sort of like hosts, mentors of the series. And it has a little bit of like a Queer Eye sort of vibe, but I feel like a much more authentic and real way than Queer Eye has sort of become. Like, I think Queer Eye feels a little bit commercialized to me, and it's also very much more focused on allyship, really, than like really fully on the queer community. So the premise of We're Here is that these three queens go to these really small towns in America, like usually a lot of times in the South or the Midwest, to these towns that are deeply homophobic, racist, like they're unsafe places for queer people to inhabit a lot of the time. And each of the queens each week has a person or a few people that they're sort of like mentoring. And at the end of the episode, they put on a drag show in this small town that they're visiting that week. Mm-hmm. And it's much more focused on most of the, especially in the second season, most of the mentees are queer people themselves. Mm. And it's much more focused on like these people who are extremely closeted, or they're in hiding, or they're just afraid or unable to be who they are because of where they live and in these very conservative, closed off sort of places. And it is so brilliantly done, because so much of the show, like what you're talking about, is about drag as an art form and what it can do for people to like get in touch with their identity or tap into some sort of confidence. For some people, it's really like drag has saved their lives, you know, and allowed them to be who they always wanted to be. And it's extremely emotional. Like, I truly cry during every episode. But it is, I don't know, I think it's sort of along the lines of what you're talking about, of just who is drag for, because there are some people involved in these shows who are allies as well, and who really are just like, I want to get up on that stage to show people that this should not be, you know, these people should not be marginalized. Like, this should not be weird. And it's so heartening to see every time they put on a show, you feel like nobody's going to show up. And there are people like clawing their way in to these like small drag shows. It's so good. And like, my Badass Bitches this week were going to be Bob, Shangela, and Eureka, who like, I, you know, I'm not super aware of their track records on Drag Race, but on this show in particular, they are just incredible mentors, just so like loving, understanding, and just wonderful to watch. I don't know. I really highly recommend the show. I know that didn't answer your question at all, but I think that's goes hand in hand.
I'm happy to hear you say that. You know, it's, you know, without giving any spoilers of their track records for you, because I, knowing that you like that show, again, I really think you should watch Drag Race. And more so, we just need to find a time just to like carve out a day when we're going to watch a whole season together.
Yeah.
Is all three of them are very impactful on Drag Race in their own unique ways. I will say, like, I have my opinions. I love Bob. Big fan.
Yeah, love that.
I have my opinions on the other two, more so Eureka, that skew a little more negative, and therefore I just haven't really wanted to follow up on more of her. But that's great to hear. And yeah, and again, to just echo back to my initial kind of bringing this up, like, I don't have... I'm trying to like actually like be like really objective and take my own personal opinion about it, because I'm like, I don't want to be close-minded. I never want to be close-minded. It just, yeah, it just comes from a place of, I feel like Drag Race and shows like We Are Here and shows like Dragula, and like, there are a lot of shows that are like based out of bringing queer culture to the mainstream, which is amazing. And I wish that that could be enough, if that makes sense. So it's kind of like how, so back in my Twitter days, before I finally got rid of that fucking toxic app, is I went like a little viral, like probably like five to 10 times.
Okay. And famous. She's famous.
Yeah. She's like, she's going places. But one tweet I had, it was like this, like, it was this video that had been posted. It was like a smash cut, like video collage of different characters in film that were representative of the LGBTQIA plus community.
Yep.
And my response was like, and barely an LGBTQIA plus actor in sight, because it was all like, you know, like Love, Simon and Brokeback Mountain and like all these like other things. And it was interesting because obviously there was going to be positive and negative feedback to any sort of tweet. But a lot of the responses were like, why does that matter? Like actors are actors. And like, even like one person I remember so vividly, like, I'm gay. Does that mean I should only play gay actors? And it's like, or gay characters. And it's like, no, it's about representation. And it's about like understanding, you know, like, yes, a film like Love, Simon is going to make an impact no matter what, because it's a great story to tell. But at the end of the day, imagine how that could be even a little bit more impactful or more representative if it was not portrayed by a straight actor who doesn't understand the experiences. And that's not to take away from any sort of actor's talent in playing these types of roles. It's just a different way of also giving queer actors, actresses, etc., opportunities to tell their own stories. And I think that's why shows like Pose are so fucking important and so groundbreaking. And so,
it's the other side of the coin, too, with that argument where it's like, we would be more okay with non-queer people playing queer characters if queer actors actually had a shot at playing non-queer characters. Like, that also sort of never happens.
Absolutely. I mean, do you think that Neil Patrick Harris would have been cast as Barney Stinson if he had been out and gay in that
moment? I was actually just going to say...
Not that's a great example, because, like, that character is atrocious.
Terrible. I know. We are on such a tangent now, but the last thing I'll say is...
No, but this is important.
This is something that was very exciting to me. I would assume that you didn't watch The Matrix Resurrections.
No, but I actually did recently rewatch The Matrix, and I was actually hoping to kind of keep watching it.
So the thing that I just thought was very cool was that, so it's obviously directed by Lana Wachowski, who created the original series, and very subtly, I mean, arguably, she just cast a bunch of queer people in straight roles in this film, because Neil Patrick Harris is in it, and like Jonathan Groff is in it, sort of playing like the main villain characters, just like normalizing that, which anyway, I don't know. I thought that that was sort of making good on the other side of that.
No, I'm really happy you brought that up, because I do think that when queer actors, when trans actors are able to be cast in roles that are not based around their queerness and their transness, yeah, then it's able to kind of flip the other way.
Yeah.
Again, really curious to hear people's thoughts.
Yeah, let us know. we should probably move on, but I think that this is so fascinating. I could really talk about it forever.
Absolutely. So my baddest pitch of the week, also falling in the queer community, and also my continued running theme of talking about musicians that I really love. No surprise to you, my baddest pitch of the week is Lucy Dacus.
I discovered
her music in 2021 upon the release of her album Home Video, which I could not recommend highly enough. She's a super talented, I believe she identifies as bisexual.
Yeah.
Neither here nor there, but you know, her music is very queer coded and just really beautiful lyrics, and you know, very, very talented musician. She has kind of one of those voices, and I put it in this like very rare category where it's like butter in the sense where it's like, she doesn't need to be hitting any sort of impressive notes. And I'm still just like listening, like, oh, like there's like the kind of like visceral, like there's something about that kind of like the timbre like of her voice.
Like a hauntingly beautiful sort of quality too.
It's a very like rich, like alto realness. One of my faves, and her album Home Video is just really kind of like based in nostalgia and looking back on your childhood, especially she was raised very religious and kind of reflecting on that. But in particular, the reason I wanted to highlight her, at least at the time we're recording this episode, is that she's currently on tour for Home Video, and she has two herniated discs in her back.
Oh my God.
And so she like posts this whole thing, and she's like, the only way I can basically like exist right now without being in excruciating pain is to lie down. So she's doing her entire tour on a couch. Like, she's on stage lying down on a couch.
I am obsessed with that. I did not know that was happening.
So I saw it. So at first, because I follow her on Instagram, and first I saw like she had canceled like a date or two. And I was like, oh, like bummer. And not that I have tickets, because unfortunately she is coming to the town I live in when I'm going to be on vacation in a week, which I'm like devastated.
Shit.
And then I saw that she was doing some performances from her couch, and I was like, oh, she must be like, it must be like a virtual something. And then I saw more and more, I was like, no, she's literally going to these venues just on her couch, like literally like playing her guitar lying down.
That's amazing. I need to see videos of this. What a queen.
Like, iconic. That is some next level queen shit. So,
hell yeah. Big do what fan. You gotta do, girl.
Yeah, like
being an artist on the like being on the road is fucking hard. Like, yeah, I don't care if you lay down, COVID. Lay down, girl.
Yeah. Oh my God. Like, can the whole audience lie down? Can I lie down? I really would like to lie down.
Yeah.
Should we just record this podcast lying down?
We've talked about this before. We used to have a setup where like we could feasibly like lie down.
I do remember like we'd be on the couch together and like one person we talked to, the person just like just like pop back up to be like, and now here's my thoughts on the bullshit.
Speaking of the bullshit.
Yeah, let's get into
this week's story. Okay. Sure. I'm gonna be telling the story this week. So I know that we had like last week was a little intense because last week would have been the Jodi Arias week, mm-hmm. which we love, but also, you know, it's a tough one. So I don't know. I guess I set out to do something that was like less dark, but it's still dark. It's a more old timey murder, which for some reason feels a little more removed to me.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so
that's just the rule.
That's the rule. Yes, exactly. So I'm going to be telling you about the Black Widows of Liverpool. Have you heard of this?
I haven't.
Great. So I got my information from good old Murderpedia and also crimemuseum.com. So we're in 1880 in Liverpool.
A great year.
Yeah, perfect year. Loved that year. In Liverpool, England. And Irish sisters Catherine and Margaret Flanagan open a boarding house at 5 Skirving Street. They'd come from Ireland to become landladies. Catherine, who was born in 1829, was 51 at the time, and Margaret, who was born in 1843, was 37, which is actually quite a big age difference for sisters.
Like ancient.
Both of them were unmarried, but Catherine had a 22-year-old son named John who lived in the boarding house with them at the time. There was like a surprisingly not like a ton of information about this out there. So like I'm piecing things together. I couldn't find it in my research, but I assume that Catherine had at one point been married and that her husband that she has this 22-year-old son with has died because they're obviously known as the Black Widows. But anyway, so in addition to the sisters and the son, there were two lodger families that began staying in the house with them. One was a man named Thomas Higgins, who lived there with his young daughter, Mary. And the other was Patrick Jennings, and he lived there with his teenage daughter, Margaret. So just FYI, we already have two Margarets. And I just want to preface that everyone in this story has the same name. Mm-hmm. We're just going to say that. So I'm going to try to use people's last names. So Margaret Please. Flanagan is the sister who owns the boarding house. Margaret.
Who's sisters to Catherine.
Sisters to Catherine. And then Margaret Jennings is the teen daughter who lived in the house.
Okay. So MF and M.
But then Margaret Flanagan gets married later. She has a dip. Right. So just, you know, it's fine. Right. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you.
I think you're with me. So anyway, within a few years, half of the people living in this boarding house would be dead. Who could have known? All right. So just to set the scene, in 1800s Liverpool, times were not great. Okay. Mm-hmm. Poverty was rampant. And many people were just, you know, just barely getting by. So life expectancy was short. Many of the residents were not in good health, etc. So in fact, in December of 1880, so like soon after they moved into the boarding house, Catherine's son, John, becomes rapidly ill. And despite being previously young and healthy, he quickly deteriorates and he dies suddenly.
Oh no.
So because death was pretty common in Liverpool at the time, they literally, basically, his death didn't really raise any suspicion. They thought he was sick. Interestingly though, his mother was able to collect 71 pounds, which is equivalent to about 7,200 pounds in today's money, to collect this money from the burial society where he had been registered before his death. So these like burial societies are an important piece of this story. So in the Liverpool area at the time, there were several of these societies that basically helped people with the costs of burying their family members. So it was basically like a not-for-profit life insurance group where all the members of the society would pay their dues for the year, and then the money would be taken out of the pot and given to any members of the society who lost a relative to help them pay for their funeral services. But as you probably expect, this is where things get a little sinister, because so Catherine and Margaret, they may have been running a somewhat successful boarding house, but they were still extremely poor. So when they hear about these burial societies, they're like, great, we have a plan.
This is it.
They realize that if they have very cheap, minimal funeral services for any people they know who die, they can just pocket most of the life insurance money that they're getting from the burial societies for themselves. And that means that, yes, Catherine's own son, John, is their first victim.
No way.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So while it looks to the outside world that he had just gotten really sick, in reality, his own mother had been poisoning him with arsenic. So almost immediately after, yes, these girls. So almost immediately after his burial, or after his death, she collects the money for his burial, spends very little of it on actually burying him, and keeps the rest of it. And this is where their plan begins. So pretty shortly after this, in 1882, a romance begins between the younger sister Margaret and their lodger Thomas Higgins, and the two of them end up getting married in October, making Margaret the stepmother to Thomas's daughter Mary. Sure enough, within a few months of the wedding, Mary, who is 8 years old at the time, becomes suddenly and unexpectedly ill and dies quickly. Very soon after, Margaret collects the burial society payout once again, and I read this detail somewhere that she's said to be making like a very public display of her grief at a local tavern, like she was very upset by this. But as you can see, these sisters truly have no regard for who they are killing, whether it be their own family members or an innocent child. So
yeah, that's so funny to me. Like I could understand if it was like, okay, we started with there was a gateway to eventually killing your own family.
Also, it is so full on.
7,000 pounds. That's not
this
that
is
much
this.
Money.
This really gets me. They are getting their hands on such a small amount of money. And I understand that it's like they're dealing with like extreme poverty in this city, but it is literally like equivalent to like a few thousand dollars, maybe, for each of the
desperate times call for killing your family.
Yeah, absolutely. You're so right, though. There was no stepping stone to it. It was like my own son and then a child who has never heard a fly. Let's kill them. Okay, so anyway, 2 months later, after Mary's death, in January of 1883, another death occurs in the same manner. This time, it's Margaret Jennings, the daughter of the other lodger, who was 19 years old at the time. Once more, the payout for her burial services are hastily collected, this time by Catherine. So This part is a little bit confusing to me, because it does seem like the burial payouts are meant to be for family members of people who died. But I think it's possible that Catherine could have registered her name anyway because the families lived together, or maybe it was with the permission of her father. I don't know. Either way, the money ends up going to Catherine and Margaret and not to the father of the victim. So they've now collected these burial pots from three deaths that happened in their household.
Crazy.
At this point, of course, people in the neighborhood are starting to talk. All three of the deaths that had occurred within the boarding house on Skirving Street had been of young, previously healthy individuals, and all of their causes of death looked similar. Of course, the reality was that the sisters had poisoned all three of them in the same way with arsenic.
Yeah, it doesn't feel that smart.
Right, but although there were suspicions, the arsenic allowed for the deaths to look relatively natural enough at the time, because it sort of just mimicked them getting really ill. And obviously, I don't know how much what was medicine in 1880?
Cocaine.
Right. So it looked natural enough at the time that they couldn't, nobody could convict the sisters of any wrongdoing. So still, in order to try to escape some of this neighborhood gossip, Catherine, Margaret, and Margaret's husband, Thomas Higgins, moved their household to 105 Latimer Street and then again to 27 Ascot Street. So at this point, I'm really sort of questioning, what is my guy Thomas thinking? You know, yeah. Like,
what's his
daughter is dead, sort of everyone he knows is dead, everyone everyone he knows under the age of 23 has died. But he's like, I love my wife so much. Like, I'm going to stick it out. So, you know what? Sure enough, by September of 1883, Thomas himself also gets mysteriously ill. So Margaret, being his doting wife, is by his side throughout his short illness.
Sure, she is.
He's having stomach pains that were so severe that they called the doctor to come check him out, which, like, kind of risky, but sure. They're like, absolutely, bring the doctor in here. Let's make sure he's okay. But the doctor attributed the illness to dysentery related to drinking cheap whiskey.
Okay. Hate when that happens.
And he'd prescribed, of course, opium and castor oil. So obviously Thomas dies 2 days later. And then a few days after that, the same doctor was contacted and asked to provide a death certificate. And he did, and still attributed the death to dysentery. So although Higgins's death by apparent dysentery didn't raise any questions for the doctor, Thomas's brother Patrick was surprised to hear that his brother, who had been strong and in good health, could have succumbed so easily to illness. So yes, this is now the second Patrick in our story. We've already had two Margarets. We're well on our way. But anyway,
Patrick, I forgot there was an initial Patrick. Who was the first Patrick? Was it the son?
He was the other father.
Okay. Whatever.
Which I honestly don't even know what happened to him. I think he somehow made it out alive. But anyway, Patrick wasn't willing to accept the diagnosis, and he wasn't about to let his brother's death just pass by without further scrutiny. So finally, someone is like, hold on just a sec. So Patrick finds out that his brother had actually been insured under 5 different burial societies, which I don't even really know how this would be allowed, but I suppose at the time it wasn't like there was some sort of online database that was like keeping track. So they probably were just able to register.
Yeah. In the 1880s. Weird.
So they probably just were able to register him under a bunch of societies. So Thomas's widow, Margaret, because she had been married to this man, ends up getting around £100 after his death, which I believe would amount to almost £13,000 today, which, like, again, I know we're very poor, but it's just like, we're really risking it all here.
Yeah. For, like, what is the cost of a human life?
Yeah. So at this point, obviously Thomas's brother, Patrick, is pretty convinced that his brother did not die from drinking cheap whiskey, and goes to the authorities with this information about the burial societies and his suspicion of Margaret. So at this point, a post-mortem examination is ordered on Thomas's body. So basically an autopsy that would not have been conducted previously because nobody had suspected foul play somehow. So to the surprise of the people who were mourning Thomas's death, the coroner apparently arrived at the home during the wake to perform the examination on the body.
Oh, shit.
So when Catherine heard that a full autopsy was about to be performed, she just, like, fled the home and ran away. So
not suspicious at all.
No, it's fine. When the full autopsy of Thomas's body was carried out, obviously evidence of arsenic poisoning was found. So his organs showed traces of arsenic in quantities indicating that the poisoning had taken place over several days. Evidence taken from the home, including, quote, a bottle containing a mystery white substance and a market pocket worn by Margaret, was examined by poison expert, Dr. Campbell Brown, who verified the presence of arsenic. He said he found arsenic dust in Margaret's pocket and an arsenic solution in the bottle. So obviously, Margaret is immediately arrested for Thomas's murder, while her sister Catherine is attempting to move from boarding house to boarding house in order to escape capture. Despite her attempts...
So is a boarding house just kind of like an Airbnb? Like...
I think that people, you know, I don't know exactly, but my understanding is it's
like a hostel,
it's a more of a long-term stay though. I think that it was, I think it's sort of somewhere between like a bed and breakfast and like an apartment. Mm. Like I think that people lived there for a longer period of time. Okay. So yeah, she's like on the run, but despite her efforts, she's taken into custody on October 16th, 1883, and both of the sisters are formally charged with the murder of Thomas Higgins. At this point, of course, it becomes clear to the police and the public that this is probably not the first time that these sisters have committed murder. So attention turns back to the three previous mysterious deaths that took place in their boarding house. So the bodies of the three previously deceased members of the house are ordered to be exhumed. So this is John Flanagan, Mary Higgins, and Margaret Jennings. And they all show evidence of minimal deterioration, which is actually a quality associated with arsenic poisoning. And they find traces of arsenic in the remains of all three of them. No surprise.
Oops.
So the investigators were curious to figure out where the sisters had actually gotten the arsenic. Apparently, this is kind of shitty, but they thought that they thought it was unlikely that the sisters would have been able to acquire the arsenic by the usual method, which was that you would visit a chemist. So basically, like, you'd go to the pharmacy and ask for it. And because the sisters were like illiterate and not allegedly like particularly intelligent, and the I don't know. So the method of getting the arsenic from a chemist was usually open to like men or doctors, not like to spinsters. I don't know.
Well, what reason would you ever go to your local pharmacy and be like, hello, can I have some poison, please?
Well, I mean, I think the thing was that, like you were saying, they literally used like poisons and like extremely dangerous drugs to treat like the common cold at this time. Like they don't fucking, you know, they were trying their best, but they, you know, so you could get it. But they were like, that's probably not how they got it. So they initially assumed that the arsenic had come from rat poison, which would have been easy to obtain. But common ingredients used in rat poison failed to show up in any of the autopsies. So they had to come up with a new theory. Eventually, they figured out that the common brand of fly paper at the time actually contained arsenic. So like the paper that you would buy that's like coated in a sticky substance that like attracts and traps flies to it had arsenic in it. So it seems that the sisters figured out that they could soak fly paper in water in order to extract the arsenic. And it turns out that this was the exact substance that had been found in one of the bottles in their home.
Oh, ew.
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
I don't know.
They suck, but they're not dumb in some way.
No, it's just not. And then more so like, obviously, like, poisoning people is terrible. Someone being like, this poison was meant for flies.
Oh,
like,
it's disgusting.
Let's boil this down, and here's your tea, honey.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, at the time of her arrest, Catherine actually claimed that the murders the sisters committed were not isolated, and she provided a list of 6 or 7 other deaths that she claimed to be murders related to burial society fraud. So, She also provided a list of 5 other women who she said had either perpetrated the murders or provided insurance to those who did. So she wasn't saying that she and her sister had committed more murders. She was trying to implicate other people who were like trying to do the same thing and collect burial money. So Catherine Flanagan's list of alleged conspirators to the arsenic deaths contained 3 poisoners other than herself, 1 accomplice, and 3 agents of the insuring groups who had provided the payouts upon the deaths and apparently knew something about the situation or like, you know, brushed it under the rug. Mm-hmm. Now, let me just say, I'm about to name a long list of people, and absolutely all of them have the same names. So, great. So we have Margaret Evans, Bridget Begley, and Margaret Higgins. These are the poisoners. Margaret Potter, a Mrs. Fallon, and a Bridget Stanton were the insurers. And Catherine Ryan was alleged to have obtained the arsenic needed by one of the poisoners. So that's like 10 people, and their names were only Margaret, Bridget, or Catherine. Just to be clear.
Everyone at this time was named Margaret, Bridget, or Catherine.
I think that's what was happening here. Yeah. So anyway,
it's like the sorting hat. It's like, what name do you want?
Very dumb, but I just truly was incredulous doing this research, being like, not again. There cannot be another Margaret. So according to Catherine Flanagan, Margaret Evans had been the instigator of the crime ring, beginning with the murder of a teenager in which Catherine Ryan obtained the poison and Margaret Evans administered it. This doesn't matter.
Okay.
But
it's interesting to hear, like, in theory, there could have been a murder before.
Yes, several.
Catherine's son.
So although Margaret Evans did not personally receive an insurance payout from the death of this teenager, there were implications that she had dealings with the boy's father, and she may have profited from those anyway. And then the women that Catherine alleged to have been involved in the conspiracy all appear often in accounts of suspicious deaths during this time period. Mrs. Stanton, for example, was linked to the insurance policies of three of the deaths, and groups of two or more of the involved women were seen visiting those who died shortly before their deaths. So in one case, when an insurance company supervisor requested to meet Thomas Higgins in the course of issuing the insurance on him, he was apparently greeted at the door of their home by a woman who was not either one of the sisters. And she led him to this person that she claimed to be Thomas. But the insurer later realized, when he saw the dead body of Thomas Higgins, that that's not the man that he'd seen. So there were these ladies were, they had a whole thing going. But the issue is that some of Catherine's testimony was sometimes contradictory to both herself and to what seemed to be like the obvious facts of this conspiracy. Mm-hmm. So she's just like going back on things that she's saying, and she's just not super credible. So ultimately, although it was decided by the prosecutor that the additional deaths probably were murder, they decided it would be too difficult to prove that anyone other than the sisters had committed them. So they also felt like, because the primary evidence against the other women was being provided by Catherine, who had every reason to attempt to like minimize her own responsibility in those crimes, they just didn't think that this could really be trusted, or like that it was going to hold up in court. So as a result, only the two sisters were tried for the crime of murdering Thomas, despite continuing suspicion by all of the investigating parties that there had been more deaths than just the four deaths from this household, and there were more murderers than just these two sisters. And I think that I don't know if there's ever justice brought for these other people, but something, just an interesting piece of it.
Yeah.
But to wrap things up, at the trial in 1884, prosecutors implicated the sisters in the other three deaths, as well as the murder of Thomas, and they were officially charged for all four of them. Catherine Flanagan's offer to provide evidence against other conspirators in exchange for leniency in her sentence was refused, as I said. So the sisters were found guilty, and they were both sentenced to be hanged. And the sentence was carried out on March 3rd, 1884 at Kirktale Prison, with the sisters attended to by a Roman Catholic priest, apparently in the middle of a snowstorm. They were 55 years old and 41 years old at the time of their deaths, and reportedly about 1,000 people came to witness the hangings of these sisters. And then they've since been dubbed the Black Widows of Liverpool. So that's the story.
I will never understand the concept of like attending an execution.
Oh my God. I know. I think
the OG true crime junkies.
Well, that's the thing is, like, don't you think there's going to be people in the future who look back on us and they're like, these bitches just for fun recorded podcasts about murder? Like,
well, it's different. Okay, so it's kind of like how I clearly have a fascination with the gruesome details of various crimes. I don't really know where it comes from. I like knowing the details. Yeah. And then I read them, or like, even like I mentioned in last week's episode, I was looking up details about Travis Alexander, his death, and it was like, oh, you can see the crime scene photo. So I was like, I'm curious. And while some stuff was blurred out, I still looked at them and was like, that was a mistake. Like, I wish I hadn't done that. Like, I took myself a little too far. So I guess, like, but yeah, I just can't imagine.
I feel like we've talked about this before. It's just like, what is the obsession with true crime and these really gruesome details? I do think part of it is like wanting to know that justice was served. So I think that's even part of the reason why like unsolved murders or unsolved mysteries like eat away at people so much, is because they're just like, it's not only just that I need to know who did it. It's that I need to know that someone didn't just get away with this.
Yeah, like they were punished for that.
Right. And I do think it's part of it.
Although, I mean, obviously this opens up a can of worms about like the concept of the death penalty. But anytime you hear about someone getting put to death, I'm like, oh.
I mean, you know, this is 1884, but
like, what else are you going
to
do?
I have to agree.
I understand also the concept. The last thing I'll say is like, if it was like the families of the victims and they're like, we want to see these bitches like burn.
Right. But a lot of the times it's the, I feel like so much of the time the families are like, we actually don't want more people to die. Like there's been enough death because of them, like let them rot in prison, you know?
Right. But I guess if there wasn't, you know, Netflix around these days, it was like, oh, you want to see some gruesome shit? You know, Margaret and Catherine and Bridget and Margaret and Catherine and Bridget are getting their just desserts down the street.
Oh my God. Wow, we are going straight to hell.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting story. Yeah, something about an old-timey murder. Always, you were like an 8-year-old died, and I was like, oh, so sad. Whereas you hear a lot about like that saying, you're like, holy shit, we're taking to the streets.
I know. Anyway, do we want to do our complaints? If you've never listened to an episode before, after we talk about the murder, then we spend like 10 minutes complaining about something petty just to make ourselves feel better. So here we are.
Just, yeah, again, a little, whatever the opposite of an amuse-bouche is.
Right. An unamuse-bouche.
I hate myself. So my complaint this week is, so as I've mentioned, I've been going back into the office, which has been really, really great for a number of reasons. But so my office is an open floor plan. Mm-hmm. So we're all basically kind of at like cubicles or desks, like in the same vicinity. And so I haven't seen anyone use headphones to like listen to music or podcast while working. No big deal. I definitely felt like a little like about it to begin with, because like I'm the type of person, I always want some sort of like auditory like stimulation in my brain.
Sure.
But part of me, after a couple days, I was like, okay, like this is nice, you know, I'm able to just kind of be productive. And I at a certain point I don't like notice that it's silent. Except when lunchtime rolls around. And I'm not blameless in the situation, because I also eat lunch at my desk like while I'm working, mostly because I'm like, I work hourly. I'm like, okay, if I work through lunch, I can leave earlier. Mm-hmm. But there's a combination of just like that random point when you start like the smells.
Yep.
That start happening where you're like, huh, suddenly it smells like curry and like tuna. And
yeah, when you're like heating up a salmon fillet in the office microwave, it's sort of like, you know, straight to jail.
But for me, it's the sounds.
Sure.
And again, this is not a victimless crime. I am, I don't know if that was the right use of that, but I am also to be blamed for this as well. But there's something very haunting and unsettling when you're like in the middle of like writing a press release or whatever, and you just start hearing, it's like it's not only, I'm not going to imitate because this is not an actual ASMR podcast, but like the masticating and just like the wet sounds and like the drinking of liquids. It's
yeah, this is very graphic.
It's very bone chilling when there's literally no other sounds happening. And every once in a while, I'll be like, okay, someone's eating, but someone else is like talking to each other across the desk. But it's when this is like the dead silent, like.
Do people in your office not talk that much during the day? Is it like pretty quiet?
It's pretty quiet because I think it's quiet because it's so quiet, if that makes sense. Like, I think that like when two people need to talk, they'll often be like, let's go over to the conference room, or let's, like, we have like different like kind of like gathering spaces, which makes sense. But personally, like, I would rather have just like noise around me.
Oh, I'm constantly screaming at my desk. I get like, that's just like, if I'm talking, no,
continue, because
I don't have anything to say.
Okay. It's also the talking to oneself, and which again, but I totally get it, where it's like, it's that quiet and you're in the middle of doing something, and you're like, wait, that's not right, or like, what did I just do? But you just like hear these like miscellaneous just like murmurs amidst the smells of last night's truffle pasta, and you're just like, all right.
God. I mean, you know what? That kind of sounds nice, because I've been working from home for like 800 straight days, and
I dropped it again.
Sorry. You're fine. The only person that I have to talk to is my cat, and I talk to her a lot.
Yeah. So. Oh, well, yeah.
And she does not fucking respond. So it's wild.
But honestly, the best type of coworker.
Absolutely. No, she's perfect. There.
She's listening. She's taking feedback. She might implement 100%. That feedback, but she is, it's going into that little cat brain.
100%. She is, all of her performance reviews are 10 out of 10, A+. I have a small complaint. Actually, it's just a technological innovation that I'm putting out there into the world. And that is, my complaint is that Apple has not yet implemented the ability to mark your text messages as unread.
Ooh.
Why are we still living in a world where if you open a text message, it's open and it just starts moving further down your list of texts as more texts come in? This is why people don't respond to you. This is why conversations die. Because the amount of times that I have like, literally, I've known that I have like a text or several texts that I need to respond to or I need to look at, but I won't open them because otherwise I'm going to forget that I opened them if I like can't respond to them right away. So I just have like these deceased texts living in my message inbox. Wow,
you are like, so right.
What? It would be so easy. Like, and I'm positive that they've thought of this. Like, there's no way that this is like a hard thing to achieve. Just imagine, like, the peace we would be living in as a society.
So I'm someone who, I say I will respond within 3 to 5 minutes to 90% of the texts I get. Like, I'm you're really good about this. Like, we're both, I think, like, very, like, on it.
Yeah.
But yeah, every once in a while, like, even, like, I'll go back and I'll be like, wow, like, I text this person and they didn't respond. And I'll go back and be like, oh, they did. I just clearly opened it in the midst of either work or, honestly, if you text me after, like, 8:30 p.m., it's a wash. Like, it's, who's to say?
Right.
Yeah, or it's like you see a text and you're like, okay, like, I need to, like, think of a response or I need to check into something before I can follow up. You were so right. Also, are you the type of person who like lets, like, what is your inbox number? I'm curious.
So this is very embarrassing to admit, but so I have like my work inbox never gets above like 15 emails, but my personal email, thousands of unread, because I'm just, it's really just that I'm subscribed to like all of these mailing lists that I never open. And I'm really bad about it.
So I'm maybe a serial killer in the sense that, like, I cannot have an unread email in my inbox. If it's something I need to go refer back to, I will star it. or I'll respond right away. I guess, like, if I get an email in the morning, I'm like, okay, I don't have time to deal with this. I'll deal with it later, or, like, deal with it in a day or two. I will leave it unread.
Yeah.
But I need that shit at zero. And actually, because of that, I just created a new burner email account.
Wow.
So whenever I'm doing, like, subscriptions and things, it all goes to there.
That is very smart. We are having... These are some incredible ideas that we're coming up with in this space. So you're welcome, everyone.
Yeah, the reason I ask is, like, I'll, like, see coworkers or friends, whatever they have. The emails are, like, thousands. And literally, I'm just like, I need to launch myself out of the closest open window because...
I do. I really get that because it's really unlike me because I do have a very, like... My personality is more organized and more, like, obsessively clean than my inbox would, you know, show you, but...
It's the only thing that's organized about me is my inbox.
Well, okay, so I guess the two of us, two halves make a whole. We are... The two of us together are one complete person, as usual.
That we are.
Anyway.
Anyway, so...
I think that's all.
Yeah. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe. Thank you for listening. Yeah. And
okay, yeah, Grant's phone has fallen no less than 5 times during this call. So
yeah, to be fair,
and that gives me a better, it gives me a better view of the nipple sometimes. So it's been
nice.
That's
true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. To be fair, you're propped up right on the Kleenex box because we are just real high tech over here at Wrestling Witch Face. But yes, be sure to follow us also on Instagram and I guess Twitter. I don't even know if it's worth promoting our Twitter anymore. We don't like
really use it. I guess we kind of gave up on that.
Yeah. So follow us on Instagram at RWF Podcast. And
all right. Thank you guys.
Thank you.
Bye, bitches.
Bye, bitches.